So she did her well-behaved Irish aristocrat act, and I did mine. Irish lost boy with two big eyes borrowed from a cow. She glided across the floor and led me back onto Broadway and into Bleecker Street, which in my ignorance and to my everlasting shame I asked her to show me because I heard it was quite cool. She took me to a gay bar. I hadn't been in a bar, let alone gay bar, for years. It took me about an hour to figure it out. There were a lot of what appeared to be very happy middle-aged men with dyed hair singing around an upright piano. Delighted they were. Not drunk, just happy. Cherubic. She went to the toilet and left me on my own for longer than I would have thought was necessary. For all I know, she might have popped across the street for a leisurely drink and come back just in time to find a burly man with whitest teeth I'd ever seen leaning against me. I was relieved to see her, and I told her so. She liked that. Of course she did. We moved on to another bar. Bit more cramped. On bar stools clumped together, she told me through her hands. She seemed to have picked up the American habit of using her hands to shape the words coming out of her mouth. How she'd won a green card in the Irish lottery, and she'd worked in L.A. for about a year before traveling cross-country and coming to New York. She became quite animated when she talked about being in New Orleans for Mardi Gras during her trip, and more specifically the dancing that accompanied it. She seemed far away when she talked about this experience. It was the only time she unclutched herself. Yes, even when we were fucking. Or should I say, when she was fucking me. I remember thinking how beautiful she looked, but that there was something else there, something unnerving. Not quite hatred. Maybe self-hatred. Yes, more like self-hatred. Whatever it was internal. She'd deal with it. I would never get that chance. That privilege. So from there to a coffee bar, which I still can't find today. Must have been somewhere off Bleecker. There were mice under the seats. While I'd have been more than happy to leave it at that, she seemed so insistent that we stay out longer. She seemed to want to hang on for more. So I ended up saying I'd really enjoy talking to her, more than I'd expected. She said she felt the same thing, with the hands again, this time reaching as if to say, hold my hand. I reached forward, and before I knew what was happening, we were kissing gently. Nothing too graceful. I was half standing and leaning across the table, with mice circling our feet. But it was nice. I felt all the cobwebs billow then blow away in a warm flush of summer air that seemed to close around me. Fuck knows what she felt, but I was in the bag right there. I would have been quite content to keep pecking her lips for another few hours. No problem. Except she deftly raised the stakes with a little stiff flick of her tongue. It was amazing. Like the pilot light came on in the flue of my dick. You know that sound? Thum. Or is it thum? Suddenly I was looking at this sweet teenage innocent like she was a cum-soaked whore. And I liked it. More importantly, so did she. I was supposed to be leaving the next day, but it was already the next day. I was probably not going to see her again till Christmas. But that wasn't even for sure. We both intended going home to Ireland for the holidays. There was nothing else for it. Want to come back to my hotel room? Epic stuff for me. Already I'd packed about 15 years of half-experienced adolescence into 2 hours, and now here was a semi-materialized 35-year-old making the pitch of his life. She muttered something about it being a bit fast, and I retreated gratefully, relieved. So we walked down the street slowly, hand in hand, looking but not too hard for a cab. In the end she turned to me and said, "We can go back to the hotel room as long as we take it easy." With that, we were walking quicker. She hailed a cab. We kissed a little bit in the back. How wonderful New York looked to me through the shimmering strands of brown hair that fell over my face between kisses. Allow me a moment here. Thanks. Before long, we arrived at my hotel, and the doorman moved in slow-mo towards us. I have a great fear of these doorman creatures, because I knew one in St. Lacroix, and all he ever seemed to do was complain about how little he was tipped. I didn't tip them at all. For what? Standing there? So my young girlfriend and I slid past his smiling, in my mind envious, face and strolled to the elevator. I was very nervous in that humming, mirrored container. Why are they always mirrored? There is nothing more frightening to me than the image of my own image from 2 or 3 different angles. So I stared at the floor. Room 901 meant 9 floors. I prayed the key would work. I also prayed she was over 18. In this country, one does not want to be associated, even jokingly, with pedophilia, and this girl did look young. I satisfied myself that she was at least in her 20s, but I still couldn't get it out of my mind that the police were going to kick in the door at any second. At one point, she turned to me, we were on the bed at this stage, and blinked innocently. "Tell me a story," she said. I must have gone white. She could have been 14. I told her a story about a woman who brought back a rat from India because she thought it was a dog. We kissed and caressed, and I ended up going down on her. Now, I don't want to get too graphic here, but I have to say it because it's true. And in my experience, rare. Her womanhood tasted better than her mouth. I could have stayed down there all night. No problem. I came up only to see if she was as pretty as I suspected. She was. This went on until it began to get light. She said we should take it easy, so easy is what we took. I was adamant that we would not go the whole way. Memories of being with Penn, body memories, began surfacing in me. I remember looking at Aisling while she slept and thinking, she's back. I've got Penny back. I used to look at Penny when she was asleep. It was nice just to let my eyes wander unchecked around the smooth skin, a living, breathing picture. Strange to be touching a naked body again after so long. I was so petrified that she wouldn't find me attractive, I didn't even take all my clothes off. Secretly, I was glad we were taking it easy, since it meant I didn't have to get into any performance issues. What if I came too quickly, or couldn't get it up? I used an AA maxim which helped. When in doubt, be of service. So I concentrated on giving her as much pleasure as I could. Penn had trained me to go down on her, and now I was glad. Aisling's sleeping face wore a gentle smile. She seemed happy enough. The next morning I said that we should go for breakfast. I got my bags together and checked out. Soon, we were in another taxi on our way to a cafe near her place. And soon, after that, I was in yet another cab and on my way back to that place. She didn't look around after I got in the cab and was whisked away. I know this because I did. Back in St. LaCroix, it still hadn't snowed. I still hadn't sold that fucking house. I was already out of my mind with paranoia, thinking my company had instigated a block on the sale of my house. I thought they were slipping some money to the realtor to restrain his enthusiasm in closing a deal. I was under tremendous pressure with a big campaign I was doing for a charity that supplied summer vacations for kids with AIDS. Big project. Big deal. Every ad agency likes to have a charity on their books for which they'll pull all sorts of outlandish favors. There are attractive incentives for this, though. One, the agency can usually do great dramatic work for a charity, more dramatic than what you'll be allowed to do for baked beans. And two, there are tax concessions and write-offs. But it's important which charity you affiliate yourself with, especially in the United States. For instance, a charity that raises funds to help addicts get off heroin isn't nearly as reliable or photogenic or even pitiable as one that treats kids with AIDS. Adults with AIDS are no good. Could be their own fault. No. Kids are good. Kids with AIDS are better. Sorry, but it's true. It's not the fault of the ad agencies. It's actually your fault. The public. And if this never gets published, it's your fault too, because it means that this kind of story was deemed uninteresting to you. You bastards. You just won't accept a heroin addict asking for money to kick his habit. Maybe you're right. Who knows? But that's it. Charities are as competitive as commercial companies and nowadays need to think like them. After all, they're chasing the same dollars. Then you've got the networks. They have a finite amount of airtime available annually for donation to charity. Which ones to give the time to? Each network has standards to maintain and are wary of letting the tone of their channels slip. It comes down to which commercial is going to make them look best. Again, you're safe with kids. So the ad agency is clever enough to pick a charity with lots of kids in it, because they know from the outset the networks will have more time for them, in this case, airtime. Anyway, let me tell you my story about summer camp for kids. We were shooting the commercial on location in Camp Northern, Minnesota. We were sleeping in bunk beds at the camp. I didn't even know what a summer camp was until I had it explained to me. Still seemed like something only middle-class kids would ever do. But there's no middle class in the United States. Yeah, right. After a fitful sleep, I made my way to the communal bathroom, euphemism for toilet, for a shit and a shave. It occurred to me that with 200 kids running around here in the summer, some of their contagions might rub off on the basins. This occurred to me just before I shaved. I thought about all the pores in my skin being opened up to all that diseased air. Christ. I went ahead and shaved, of course, and after a few appreciative glances at myself, I was satisfied that while I hadn't slept well, I didn't look as if I hadn't slept well. I was careful not to smile at myself. I want never to be caught smiling at myself in a mirror. It's okay in private. Out for breakfast I went. The crew and the director were already assembled around steaming plates. They looked rough and unshaven. This pleased me. I sat down and dug into eggs and toast or whatever was on offer. Coffee. Then the camp boss and general all-around hero of the day came in, all bubbly, wringing his hands and lowering his eyes with excess humility. He ran the camp and was the founder of the whole thing. I noticed he, too, was unshaven. This was very uncharacteristic of him, since he was always very particular about the way he looked. In fact, apart from being unshaven, he seemed his normal, well-dressed self, but in country wools and tweeds. The blood in my veins began to curdle. He risked a humble look around the table. He was looking only for information. Who was at the table? Who did he need to be nicest to, and in what order? He stopped at me. You didn't shave, did you? I must have gone white. Yes, I did. Oh, come on, I'm very disappointed. I was about to ask him how he thought I felt. We don't shave here at camp. It's meant to be informal, but I suppose since, strictly speaking, you're still at work, we'll let it go this time. I laughed a genuine laugh. I would live. And more important, I wouldn't need a test for HIV before meeting my beloved again. Being in that camp, with birds singing and children everywhere being so cute and nice to each other, had awoken something familial in me. I saw Aisling and me living somewhere wooded like this, light dappling our happiness, laughter echoing around trees before we shushed each other, lest we wake the baby. How fortunate we'd consider ourselves to be that our child was not infected with some horrible disease or other. My future wife's phone number burned away against my thigh and the inside of a drawer and in a few other places I couldn't remember. I'd taken the precaution of writing it down on separate pieces of paper in case I lost it. I had to resist the temptation to call her. A lot. Physical cravings. I was in a bad way. I mean, I hadn't even looked at a girl for 5 years, and now it was all over me. I didn't even know what it was. I never really had those feelings before. I wince now to look back on it, but I really was in love. Or infatuated. My eyes got heavy when I thought about her. My pupils dilated when I just thought about her. The ads for the camp turned out pretty good, and one even went on to win an award. All the kids featured in them have since died. Don't quite know what to do with that. But there you go. It's easy for me to be totally honest here because the possibility of anyone ever publishing this is so remote. At least I'll benefit from it as a form of therapy. Did I feel love or obsession? I still don't know. Somehow the thought of her, or even the thought of calling her, got me through those Minnesotan nights. So I called her, and we chatted. About advertising mostly, and therefore about me. I thought she was interested. Maybe she was. At least that would have made it a bit more enjoyable for her. I can't help thinking that she must have treated this part of the whole thing like a prostitute treats the talking bit before the sex. You have to listen to some of their shit before they feel comfortable enough to get a hard-on. And they have to get the hard-on, or they won't have the sex that you need them to have with you in order for you to get paid. This is what I thought was going on. She listened to me. I just know she listened to me. There I go again. The male ego. Like the guy who believes the hooker comes when she seems to. I want to believe she listened to me and liked me. And yes, even loved me a little bit. Even now I seem to want to believe that. Crazy, huh? I used to say crazy, eh? But now it's, huh, America. In Minnesota, I'd been in a terrible state of mind for almost 2 years, and I felt I deserved something good to happen. Having been in New York now for over a year, I can see how innocent and silly I must have sounded to a 27-year-old, hungry-as-fuck photographer determined to crack the New York scene. Fair enough. Her fascination must have been of the morbid variety, but mine wasn't much more developed. I wanted her to help me out of St. LaCroix. I wanted her to be my pathfinder in New York. I wanted her. I wanted a lot. I had my reasons, and I suppose she had hers. To her, I must have seemed like a big, wet, fat, bald, overpaid culchie, a name reserved for anyone from outside the Dublin area. Ripe for harvest. Aisling would have seen a lot of my type in her travels as a photographer's assistant. Shoots in Miami, the light, darling, were commonplace for photographers from cloudy New York. Lots of hotel rooms and bars and long shoots. Loads of art directors like me with money and wives and kids and mortgages. I hope I stuck out because all I had of these was the mortgage. She must have thought I was married, though, or hoped it. You see, I couldn't help thinking she was gathering information on me for some later use. Perhaps she wanted material to blackmail me against the wife she imagined me to have. Well, why else would I be living in a 3-bedroom Victorian house? The reason for the blackmail? Get big, juicy commissions from the ad agency. It'd be worth a lot to her as a fledgling photographer to get a job or two from such a renowned company. I thought, what the hell, she's very pretty, I'm lonely, I'm also in need of a courage booster. I wouldn't have had the balls to do the next bit if I hadn't had a tasty chick egging me on. I gave her the power to pull me out of there. I started calling the personnel department, inquiring about how to resign, as if I didn't know. I wanted them to know I was serious. I was past caring. In reality, it was a crazy move. They must have been sure I was in love. And let's face it, I was. I made a point of asking if what we discussed was confidential, knowing they'd have to inform the group head in such a situation. So I was able to threaten resignation without having to resign. Graham, my boss, knew what I wanted him to know, that I was serious. It didn't take long before he asked me in passing whether I'd sold my house. I'll never forget the expression on his face. God help me, but I enjoyed it. And again, believe me, I got my version of this happening to me later, but this was my moment. The best way I can describe his pale face is to say that it rippled. From below his chin and upward to his hairline, one solitary ripple, like milk. He was that pale. It took a couple of beats for its significance to register in him, and then in me. I didn't think it would matter that much to him one way or the other, but seemingly it did. He really must have thought he had me for another couple of years. If I'd succumbed to the Swedish women, he probably would have. The next day, he called me in to say that I was to fly to New York to help out at the office for a few weeks. I didn't know that I wouldn't be coming back, but I hoped it. I'd be able to see my Aisling. I didn't care about the job. Fuck the job. I was sick of advertising and everyone in it. All I wanted was a few weeks paid up in a nice hotel in New York with my love. Back at Fort Fuckup, my nickname for the house, I'd speak to her. I'd imagine she was sitting in a chair in front of me. I'd look lovingly at the middle distance just above the chair as if into her green eyes and cock my head, impressed. Nodding courteously, I'd lean forward and agree almost reluctantly with what she had to say. She was so intelligent that even I had to concede a point. And then I would laugh happily. Because I was happy. I was conducting a love affair. The perfect love affair with no interruptions from anyone else. I saw a cartoon that had a picture of Narcissus staring at his own reflection in a pond. His girlfriend is asking him, Narcissus, is there someone else? If they fired me at the end of my New York sojourn, fine, at least I'd have had a few memorable moments. I had tried to organize trips to New York before, but they'd all fallen through. Each time I desperately tried to hide the disappointment in my voice as I told Aisling I couldn't make it after all. I'd kick myself as I felt any hope of our relationship slip. It was killing me. Then I'd call on Saturday morning around 10:30 and she wouldn't be there. The 1-hour difference made it even more anxiety-provoking. 9:30 a.m. in New York? Jesus, my mind would have fun with that, I can tell you. Not there? Obviously on her way home from some guy's flat, or maybe even still fucking him. Why not? She got into bed with me the first night we went out. But that was different. That was love. That was with me. I'd call and offer to turn up there one weekend. This she would deflect gracefully, saying it was nicer if I didn't have to pay myself. Better to wait for a business trip. She was right, of course, but I was gagging for some sex. I could see also that she was ambitious. Not afraid to talk about her work. This scared me a little because it meant she was interested in me only because of my position as senior art director. I hated the word senior. Made me sound old. To her, I must have seemed old as fuck. I consoled myself that I didn't look much more than 32. She played along with that. What pretty just-turned 27-year-old wouldn't? She was having an exhibition, she said one night. I was so glad she was involving me in her life enough to tell me this detail that I offered to help. I tried to impress her with my talents as a media manipulator, but she wasn't impressed. Disappointed, more like. I wanted to cheapen the whole thing by putting a St. Patrick's Day spin on it. Now I can see how this must have made her more comfortable with what she was going to do. It's funny how after we decide we don't like someone, we can find reasons to support our decision, and equally the other way around. That's what I think was happening. As I got further in, I had already decided I liked, nay, loved her, and progressively began gathering and threading together a daisy chain of little observations and nuances that tied her tenderly to me. Concurrently, she was compiling her own list of grievances. I remember silences after I'd say something, the type of silence in which you let the now silent speaker stew, like a spotlight on what's been said, like repeating something in a cold, dispassionate voice. And in those rests she took from me, she refueled her fervor to complete what she must have already begun. Here's what I know about her. 27 years old, Aisling McCarthy, photographic assistant, worked as a project manager in a big clunky design firm in Dublin in the early 1990s. Left Dublin after winning a green card in the lottery, told me that she had to leave Dublin in a hurry. Worked in LA for about a year, worked as a hostess in the Green Room, a four-star restaurant that catered to Dublin's elite. I try not to define hostess unless I'm feeling particularly unkind. She loves Deilford, my hometown, and her stepdad, Mr. Tom Bannister, the solicitor of my father, now dead. Her mother is from Ballina. Fairly patriotic towards Ireland, but not in an unattractive Fenian sort of way. When I knew her, she worked as one of Peter Freeman's assistants. Big shot photographer. Very big shot photographer. Probably one of the best in New York, and therefore, the world. She was sharing an apartment in New York's Lower East Side with two roommates. Her home in Ireland is in Whiteheath. Very fucking posh, believe me. And she looks very, very young. She's been mistaken for 16. Spent time in a convent boarding school as a kid. There was a nun with whom she was quite close. Also, her grandfather died during the time I knew her. She is obsessed with portraiture, specifically high contrast, black and white. She's been in Spain and worked at a museum. All this data retained after one short evening and no more than 4 phone calls. She could never accuse me of not listening. If anything, I listened too much. I was trying to soak her up into me. I could have written a book about her. Whoops. She went on holidays once with her family to Peru. She said she was disgusted by the way they looked at her. So fair-skinned in those leather-faced, raven-haired surroundings. A lot of computer learning was required in her new job. She encouraged me to set up my own agency in Dublin. She liked to drink Guinness. She got help with her work from Peter Freeman. He even came in on the weekends a few times to help her. I was jealous when I heard this. That's about it. Apart, of course, from the rest of what I'm going to tell you, I will say this, and I'm surprising myself here because I'm normally more cautious. If there was a way that I could torture and kill her without going to prison, I would. Or I feel like I could. Don't worry, I don't daydream about how or what I'd do. I just feel capable of doing her harm. I won't, though. These pages are the nearest I will ever get to evening up the effects of that evening in March. But let's not jump ahead here, shall we? I've been thin with rage for almost 6 months. To cause that kind of lividness in someone takes a certain amount of talent, and, I'd like to think, intelligence. Love? Hate? What's the difference? One night on the phone, she told me she had a publishing deal. That's interesting, I said, and asked her what kind of deal and how did she manage to wrangle that. I was always interested in avenues that could lead out of advertising. She said she had some friends studying publishing at Princeton. I tried not to gulp. These were rich motherfuckers we were dealing with here. I forgot, of course, that I was making serious bucks by then. I never felt rich, just silly, especially in that house. The book would consist of photo essays, she said, portraits. She already had some done, but she had a couple of years to complete them. I was immediately jealous. I yearned to do something pure, something that didn't need to sell something. Maybe you'll be in it, she said. This was left open. I didn't know if I should be flattered, but I was. We arranged to meet in Dublin while we were both home in Ireland over Christmas. I called from St. La Croix and booked a nice room in the Shelburne Hotel in Dublin. St. La Croix was fucking freezing as I jumped gratefully into a cab, exhaled loudly, and in an American accent told the driver to take me to the airport. It was a 45-minute drive, and no, I did not want to converse. The flight was long, too. 8.5 hours. Actually, it was more because of North-South Airlines, the worst airline in the world. Delays were standard. I only ever brought carry-on luggage because otherwise the bags would end up being delivered 2 days later to wherever you were. People were always shouting at North-South staff, and they, obviously accustomed to being shouted at, wore professional masks of indifference. They were the only airline out of Minnesota, so there wasn't a lot you could do, except shout. I expected to be very tired before I met my loved one in Dublin. I built in a few hours to allow me some sleep in the Shelburne before waking to find a message under my door. There, on Shelburne Hotel stationery, was one of those please call while you were out things with ticked boxes. Aisling, in beautiful handwriting, headed the ensemble of Victorian typography that seemed so exotic now after a year and a half in the history-free environment from which I had just been delivered. I still had an hour or so to kill before calling her at 7 p.m. as requested by the ticked box. I needed some condoms and began to panic because I couldn't remember if Ireland was still medieval in that department. There was a time not too long ago when you couldn't buy them. They had to be prescribed. I went for a walk. I turned right out of the Shelburne's beautiful front door and headed towards Grafton Street. I had to hold back the tears. I don't think I can capture what it felt like to walk among all those beautiful young faces. It was as if someone was going to shout, "Not him. No, everybody else is allowed to walk through here and laugh and be easygoing and dress well, but not him. He shouldn't even be here." It was so lovely. I don't even know if it was Grafton Street. It was pedestrian only, the day before Christmas Eve. I'll never forget the moment. I even found a Boots chemist, which made me feel like I was in London. Dublin had changed so much, and so had I. I was sadder. But after buying a 12-pack of condoms, hey, some of them might break, I cheered up somewhat. I walked back to the hotel feeling like somebody who just got out of prison. I called her home number from my room and got some guy. Her dad? Her stepdad? Jesus, I wasn't expecting that. So I just said I'd call back later or something. He didn't sound too happy. At 7 o'clock, she called back and said we should meet at the corner of Grafton Street in that big glass shopping center thing. I knew it and tried to remain calm. I agreed to see her there in 15 minutes. 15 minutes. I strolled there and waited for her across the road. She was a little late, but very beautiful. I had to keep checking to convince myself that she really was as lovely as she seemed. She, I thought, was doing the same thing with me, but I realized now she must have been checking how moon-faced I looked, how easily taken in I was. We had something to eat in a nearby cafe, and it was there that the first photo was taken. I didn't really even notice it, but I saw something in her eyes after she clicked the little disposable camera button. She said it probably wouldn't even come out in the dimly lit restaurant. Earlier, I had asked her if she carried a camera around. She said she did, but that I'd laugh if I saw it. I said I wouldn't. She said I would. So I said, okay, I would. She took out a disposable camera, the kind you see at newsagents, and tilting it off the tabletop so that it pointed upward under my chin, she clicked the shutter. I remember I was looking at her when she took it, looking directly into her big, innocent green eyes. Click. I immediately felt robbed. She'd got my moon face. My idiotic stare had been sucked off my face, replaced by an expression of distrust. Only for a moment. My first instinct had been right. I knew that a shot taken like that, impromptu, no waiting, taken by a professional, wasn't meant to be flattering. She had water with the meal, and later we ended up in the pub in Temple Bar where she drank Bacardis and Coke for the rest of the evening, as I downed about 5 bottles of Bally fucking gown water. She must have been out of her mind by the time we returned to the hotel. I was pleased about how I handled that. I said, "It's a pity you can't come back to the hotel." "Why, are there rules? Can't you have people back?" she asked. No, I just assumed you wouldn't be able to come back, well, with your parents and... Oh, no, I'd like to come back. Ding, ding, full steam ahead. Mind those icebergs. We strolled back to the hotel, her clasping my stumpy hand in her long fingers. The evening was beautiful and the trees along Stephen's Green were yellowed by the streetlights against the navy sky. We didn't say much. She'd been kissing me, non-stop. There was one time when her big eyes dilated and then her pupils shrunk to little pinheads. That freaked me out a little. I didn't know if she was on something or not. In the room, we got down to business in what I now see as a fairly matter-of-fact manner. We used MTV as lighting. It was great. I loved it. She was very beautiful. Very. I suppose I wouldn't even be writing this if she hadn't been. It wasn't every day a guy had the chance for unrushed sex with the Virgin Mary when she was 16. She had a great angular back. I had hair on mine. I couldn't stop giggling. Actually, there were even moments when I laughed out loud. She got a bit annoyed by this. I couldn't stop, though. It felt so good. When I feel good like that, I laugh. She thought I was laughing at her. Also, I was nervous. It had been, yes, we know, 5 years. We rolled around and basically kept ourselves busy till dawn. I can remember her on top of me at one point, her long, rich brown hair falling forward as she pumped me. The hair formed a darkness that looked like the interior of the hood of the Grim Reaper. Like something out of one of those horror movies where from the darkness you see the faint glint of two little red beads. I couldn't help thinking about how she said she'd been to Mardi Gras in New Orleans and how she'd been impressed by the dancers and the atmosphere of the whole festival. I imagined some fucked up voodoo types smothered in chicken's blood. Only this was Dublin. We were a long way from Louisiana now, and the dawn was knocking gently on the window. I began to prepare myself for our parting. We ordered breakfast and I took a shower after her. When I came out of the bathroom, she was leaning out the window, taking photos with her little disposable camera. No doubt we'd be seeing them again soon. God knows what else she took while I was transferring from the bathrobe to my clothes. But she had all the opportunity she needed. So on the way to the elevator, she walked ahead of me. She turned to me, fixed me in those big green headlights and said, "I look like shit." "You don't look that bad." I was trying not to let her know just how beautiful she did look. "That bad," she quipped, obviously annoyed. I winced. She made a phone call from reception. She'd made one the night before, too, to let her parents know she wouldn't be home. We had coffee, and I got a cab to Houston Station, and that was it, basically. The second Christmas after my dad died, I was home. We did all right, Ma and me. My dad always loved Christmas, so the empty chair really stuck out this time of the year. But I was optimistic. Well, actually, no. I was high. I had a gorgeous Irish girlfriend, and my house was in the throes of being sold, which meant St. Croix, as a city of residence, was nearing the end of its reign. I was a cheerful influence around the house that Christmas. My brother visited, I went to my AA meetings, Aisling even visited me in Deilford, and we had coffee in a new cafe. A converted bank. Ireland had changed so much. Nothing bothered me. In hindsight, I think she wanted to invite me to a New Year's party that one of her friends in Dublin held every year. She was in Deilford to visit her stepdad and had broken away to see me. It was 2 days before New Year's Eve. Maybe she had wanted to do on New Year's Eve what she ended up doing to me in the Cat and Mouse Bar in New York 3 months later. I have nothing to indicate that this is the case except my notoriously faulty intuition paranoia. The night that we'd met in Dublin, she had mentioned that a friend of hers was visiting from New York for the Christmas period, and that she'd left him in a bar somewhere. When we first met and kissed that night, there was a strong smell of alcohol, so she must have had a few drinks with him before meeting me. I, of course, protested that he shouldn't be left alone, that we should invite him to join us. Her long hands wiped away the suggestion, "He's too rude, you wouldn't like him." I believe I met him the following March in the Cat and Mouse. Back in the bank bistro, I think the fact that I had already arranged to see some friends in London for New Year's Eve postponed my soul searing for a few more months. I booked a room in the Hotel Constance for the night after New Year's Eve in the hope that we might repeat our night of sex the week before. And I thought it'd be a nice surprise for her since she worked there once as a hostess. I called her from London on New Year's Day after a disappointing night out with my AA friends. Her mother answered, She was very pleasant and asked who should she say was calling. Hoping that Aisling had mentioned me, I told her. Sorry, who? My chest caramelized. And when the girl of my dreams did finally fumble sleepily with the phone and say hello, I could hear the disappointment in her croaky voice. Then the no's began to emerge from the receiver in single file. No, she had to spend time with her parents. No, she saw them rarely enough as it was. No, maybe when we're both back in New York. No, no, no. I didn't tell her I'd booked the hotel. Easy, since I'm quite accomplished at hiding disappointment. At the Hotel Constance, there's a 100% cancellation charge. Just in case you're ever thinking about it, you should know that that means you don't get your money back. My sister put it best. Sounds like an expensive wank. She also has an enviable command of the English language. And with the Constance charging 400 euros a night, she had a point. I did everything I could not to call Aisling until I got back to St. Lacroix. I really didn't want to go back at all. She was now the only subject that held any interest for me. I hated my big, wonderful job. Hated wasn't even the right word. It was too active. This felt more like apathy. I carelessly remarked to people whose tongues were loose that I was unhappy and would soon resign. Up until that point, I was afraid to even think such a thing in case they heard me. But now, I wanted to be fired. I would have welcomed it. They didn't fire me, though. Far from it. When I got back from the Christmas break, they sent me to New York. It was obvious that I didn't give a shit anymore and I wanted to be in New York. So they arranged it. Officially, I was to go on help for a few weeks, but I knew I was never coming back. I think they knew it too. Especially since the sale of my house was set for February 2nd. 2 months earlier, a young couple had turned up on my doorstep. Hi there, we're just wondering if you'd be interested in selling your beautiful home. I had to resist hugging them. Perfect people. Perfect words coming out of their mouths. After so long in advertising and so many late nights poring over stock photo books full of people just like this couple, I was beginning to think that I was the only one who farted long, loud, sonorous notes and wanked off in the bathtub. They just seemed to confirm that I shouldn't have been in this house in the first place. It was as if I was giving it back to its rightful owners. An answered prayer is not something I was used to. They must have passed the house when the real estate sign had been up and waited. Clever. Because now that I had finished with that agent, neither of us had to pay a commission. Escape to New York was no longer just a dream. I was to fly out on Sunday night. I left two messages for Aisling saying I'd be in New York the following weekend. I intentionally didn't tell her I was going to be there forever. I knew she'd keep putting me off. On Sunday night, she left a message saying how she thought it was funny, but she was going to be in Miami that Sunday. Hilarious. I knew I was in for a fucking roasting. I just never could have guessed how sophisticated the roasting would be. So on Tuesday night, around 7, she called me in my Soho Grand hotel room, where they give you a black goldfish of your own, and where I envisaged fucking her not inconsiderable brains out later that night. Not to be, my friends, not to be. This night began the unfurling of events that still make my mouth go dry. We agreed to meet in Georgina's, a cafe bar on Prince Street. I was there early and sat at a little table. Wearing a white jacket, she turned up looking tired. Mercifully, not too beautiful. By the way, I'm aware that up to this point I sound like a jilted boyfriend trying to disguise his attempt at revenge, i.e. this whole story, as a literary event that you, the listener, are supposed to be taken in by. Maybe, but I think you'll agree that the antics of Aisling are worth recording under any pretense. Call it a warning to my brother romantics. Call it paranoid ravings. Call it what you like. Call it therapy for me, and you lot are eavesdropping. Mind you, if she does recognize herself in these pages, then that's fine too. Of course, could backfire and make her famous. Still, this occurrence would indicate a lot of these books will have been sold, which means I won't have done too badly either. Still listening? Back to Georgina's. I said something about how nice the bar was. Coming from St. Lacroix, I meant it, too. I said something about seeing photos of it somewhere and asked if it was famous. I'll never forget the cold look in her face as she said, "You'll remember it after tonight." I watched to see if she meant something good by this comment. Didn't seem so. I stuttered a little. What do you mean? Am I in for some big surprise tonight? I wanted to keep it ambiguous. "Wait," was all she said. That was not what I had expected, and it scared me. Wait? There must be a schedule of some kind, an order, a structure she had in her mind about how the evening should proceed. I swallowed hard, like someone who realizes he's in over his head. Something not good was going to happen. But it wasn't necessarily happening right now. It would happen soon, and she knew what it was, and I didn't. I couldn't leave yet because I had nothing to react to. She began peppering me with questions. Where were the Killall and Fitzpatrick offices? Did I ski? Did I work out in the gym? Did I ever go horseback riding? Did I play chess? I answered no to all of these questions. I felt like I was being interrogated. What the fuck was this? It made me feel very inactive. She said she'd love to play chess with me someday. I said I'd thought that being beaten at chess was doubly humiliating for me because I fancied myself as a bit of a strategist. Her eyes glinted. She was having fun. I couldn't help shifting uncomfortably in my chair. She sat back and watched me squirm. She looked relaxed. Not so innocent now. More at ease with herself. Totally in control. I envied her this feeling, even though I didn't know what she was in control of. I would soon find out. She looked around, crossed her arms, then a little mannered yawn. Bored. I think I'll go home now, she said. The significance of this didn't occur to me until some time later, but I did know her dismissal was significant. She let it sink in. I must have managed to ask a question that would enable me to ascertain whether she intended to go home alone. I can't remember quite what she said, except that it felt like I was being murdered. Awful drama queen, aren't I? There's a scene in Saving Private Ryan in which a German soldier is killing an American soldier with a knife. The German is on top of the Yank. The GI begins to plead softly with the German, saying something like, "Hold on, can't we talk about this?" To no avail. The German almost apologetically proceeds with the knife. His face belies the act he is committing. In case you're wondering, I'm the American. So here I was being knifed, but with bandages applied immediately after. So much so, I almost ended up apologizing to her. I was in the way, causing her beautiful brow to wrinkle. How could I? The thing was, if she'd told me to fuck off, I'd have left. But she didn't. She was enjoying herself too much. It took a good hour to get her to say she wasn't looking for a relationship. Like I was a fucking shop steward trying to understand her ladyship's requirements. At least I was able to make a clear judgment on what that meant, and what that meant mostly, if I'm honest, was no sex. So my first reaction was, okay then, fuck this. She said she'd love for me to go to exhibitions with her, and she'd love to show me around New York, and I was already shaking my head. It dawned on me that she had used almost all the cliches except the big one. I did it for her. You mean you want us to be friends? She wouldn't commit to this, because it probably sounded too final and she knew I'd scarp her. She tried to leave it open, saying, I want to get to know you better. This implied maybe we could get going again in the future. My instincts were to get up, leave, and call it a bad day. But she seemed to want to discuss it more, as if to hear my thoughts. She said, you look thoughtful, and are you angry? To which I replied, do I? I'm sorry, angry? No, why should I be angry? I'm the one who came here. It was my decision. I sensed she was disappointed with my reaction. She wanted me to be angry, and I took the whole thing so well. Anyone would think she was telling me about her new curtains. At least that's what I hoped. She seemed even more bored now that she wasn't getting the show of emotion she'd hoped for. Then, without warning, a light blinded me. Flash! I couldn't see. Was in shock. The guy next to me turned, grinning, and said, sorry, it just went off. I nodded automatically. It's okay, no problem. He exchanged glances with Aisling. She was smiling. So was I. So was he. I hadn't even noticed that there had been a camera on the adjacent table beside the salt and pepper shakers. I looked at the man again. Something was wrong. I didn't know what. He seemed far too happy about his little accident. And the timing was too precise, as if he realized that the emotional peak had been reached. There would be nothing more expressive than the face I was wearing, so the shot had to be done now. The unwitting photographer and his accomplice remained beside us at the other table. Aisling asked me if I wanted something to drink. I still had my Perrier. I took this to mean, did I want something stronger? I was very hurt by this, considering what had already happened. But my pain was easy to conceal. All I wanted to do now was get away from her and get on with nursing what would definitely be a broken heart. Something in me wouldn't give up, though. I asked her if she wanted to go for a walk. She reacted too loudly, over-emphatically, saying, "No," and then more mildly, "It's freezing outside." I couldn't get it out of my head that she was following some prearranged structure. I'd read a cynical article in a women's magazine about how to break hearts and enjoy it. There were many helpful anti-man techniques, including, and I'm paraphrasing here, find out his hobbies before dumping him. He may be useful as a friend, or you may want to introduce him to one of your friends, especially if he's good in bed. What better gift for a close friend? Get good at chess. There is nothing more humiliating for a man than to be beaten intellectually by a beautiful woman. You'll be able to cause him physical pain. If he doesn't let you know how he's feeling, call him late. Wake him up. It's hard for him to hide his feelings when he's in love with you, and you're speaking softly to him in bed, even if it's only on the phone. These were some of the tips mentioned in the article. Aisling had fulfilled a good many of these tips before the evening was through. All of this occurred to me in retrospect. At the time, I had too much on my plate to analyze. I just ate what was put in front of me, so to speak. You have to remember that I had a lot going on. New city, New York, basically a new job, Kilallen Fitzpatrick, new assignments, freaky. Then this. As far as I was concerned, I'd moved to New York to be with this girl, and she was just laughing at me. That's how I saw it. That would have been quite enough, but there was this extra layer, this unnerving feeling that there was an agenda, a hidden agenda. Looking back, I find it even more terrifying. At the time, I think I was protected by shock or, dare I say it, God. I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to talk a little bit about a deity here. I prayed every day for a month or more to be delivered from St. Lacroix. I was delivered. When I look back on the whole experiment and psychological torture, for that's what it was, I wonder if I had known what was going on sooner, would I have used it as an excuse to drink? We alcoholics like our excuses. Or would I have taken an ineffectual swing at someone or come out of some red mist with her limp body held at the throat by what I'd slowly realized were my hands? The rage I felt later as it dawned on me what had happened was almost visible around me. As always, I have my theories. Because I met her at Brian Tompkinson's studio, I thought it might be a setup. Tompkinson did a huge amount of work for Kilallen Fitzpatrick, and therefore favors. He took the occasional free shot here and there when asked, because he knew it was good business to keep in with one of the best advertising agencies in the world. It was common practice. One conspiracy theory is that Kilallen Fitzpatrick didn't like the idea of someone they'd invested in so heavily leaving for New York, so they wanted to help me ruin myself by introducing me to a young lady from Ireland who wanted to further her own career. She got the job with Peter Freeman very soon after showing me a good time in New York. I'm just talking here. I know it's far-fetched, even for me, but I had decided Kilallen Fitzpatrick was a fucking weird place. The other theory could exist alongside the one above, or on its own, if you prefer. Theory number two supports the artistic coffee table book route. In this version, she has two friends from Princeton studying publishing. They have already negotiated a publishing deal and approved the concept of a high-quality book of photography featuring photo essays in the style of those true romance picture sequences that used to be more commonplace in the 1970s. In this case, though, each romance would feature one girl with different guys. The photo essays would record the progression from the very beginning to the very end. In theory two, I am one of those guys. Theory three is that theories one and two are bullshit, and life is random, and therefore everything that happens has no meaning or structure, it just happens or doesn't. As the man with the lisp said on hearing about the fate of the Titanic, unthinkable. So there you have it. My money is neatly spread over the areas of theories one and two, with most of it on two, just so you know. If we look at theory two, she had covered the early stages of our true romance, and even the beginning of its demise. But she didn't have anything decent, just moon-faced shots of a man too much in love. No anger, no tears, no anguish. What's a romance without anger, tears, and woe? Can't have a book entitled True Friendship, can we? Well, of course not. Not if you've got a publishing deal, which means a deadline and money spent from a set budget, which you've been allotted to help you gather material. And not if you've already invested quite a bit of time and energy into your subject. Oh, no. Another photo flashed outside Georgina's as I raised my hands, tilted upwards, in what could, I thought, be misconstrued as a pleading gesture, and that particular page in her forthcoming book turned over. The next day, after promising I'd call her, I did everything I could to resist leaving 15 pleading messages on her machine. In the end, I left a message saying I couldn't see her that night and that some work had come up and that I'd see her around. My hand was shaking. It took everything I had, which wasn't much, to make that call. My intention was never to call her again. Ever. I was going to use the same method I'd been taught to kick the booze. Keep it bite-size, 1 hour at a time, 1 minute. Jesus, it was torture. My ego would tell me I was hurting her needlessly by not calling her, that I was hurting her, that she had to play hard to get. That was what girls had to do. Anyway, I somehow got through another day, and that night at around 11:30, she called me in the hotel. I was asleep. It had snowed earlier, and I had tried to meet Thelma, but she wasn't around that night. When the phone rang, I woke up, and who was I talking to? The source of my worst nightmare. She got me talking about some of the stuff I swore I'd never say to her. I wince now just thinking about it. All that naive shit about Tom Bannister and my father and that she must be the one and how I threatened to resign from my job if I wasn't sent to New York and, oh God. I was half asleep and I didn't know what I was saying. She encouraged me, of course, consoling me with things like, I didn't know that and you should have said, or that's different. I took these barely audible utterances to mean there was hope. That's the other thing I remember about our phone conversations. I could never fucking hear her. I was too embarrassed to ask her to repeat what she'd said. I spilled my guts out and in the end left it at, I'm not going anywhere under the banner of Buddy. I hung up, proud at least that I'd managed to initiate the ending of the call. That's how pathetic I had become. She ended the relationship and I ended the phone call. Not exactly 1-1 on the scoreboard, but it would have to do. Until 2 days later. I couldn't hold out. I called her and left a message saying something about having thought about what she said and that I wanted to meet her for lunch. In my mind, lunch was less of a commitment than dinner. She left the message back saying we could meet for dinner that night, Sunday, if you're feeling up to it. That fucking killed me. It implied that she knew her effect on me. Exactly the effect. I couldn't stop myself. I had to get my fix. I called her and we arranged to meet at a French restaurant not far from where she worked. She was preparing for an exhibition opening the following Wednesday. She was working quite hard. I suppose I should have taken that into account. I was trying to see it from her point of view. Guy turns up in New York, expecting her to drop everything for him just because it suited him to leave St. Lacroix. A guy she was only lukewarm about to begin with. Now he was acting all hurt because she didn't want to have sex with him. I could see that. The problem, though, was that there was these photographs being taken. Halfway through our conversation in the charming French restaurant on Lafayette, there was another camera flash, this time from a table of four on the opposite side of the room. They laughed and even waved. I couldn't be sure if the light was facing me or whether they'd just taken a shot of themselves. But in retrospect, where would we be without retrospect, it fit the pattern. The people at the other table had bags. So what? Bags that were for equipment, not clothes. Okay, maybe I'm stretching this one a bit thin. Even for me. Another shot was definitely taken that Sunday night. I even made a joke about it. I was telling her how my old partner and I had been on TV in London for an outrageous ad we'd done. I was trying to impress her. To let her know that she was dumping a fucking media genius. And I ended up telling her how much I disliked my former creative partner, saying, he's the one you should be trying to fuck up instead of me. He deserves it. He's not a good person. You and your friends should have a go at him. I nodded at the other table. Now you'll have to forgive me here because my memory tells me that she replied with a meaningful look, so you know. And then my memory goes on to tell me that I replied, of course I know. Why are you doing it? Because it's interesting to me, I said. Now that could have meant anything, but I know what I thought it meant. And I do apologize, because I can't even be sure this verbal exchange even took place. I did, however, mention my ex-partner and even told her where he worked, in case she wanted to fuck him up. By the way, I did hear that he'd recently visited New York for a wedding, and that consequently had come to work here. Say no more. Anyway, I paid the bill and explained to her that I was on an expense account and that I was making more money just by being in New York since the hotel bills and every scrap of food were expensed. She seemed jealous of this. Money was the only subject where she showed emotion. Her lovely eyes would widen when the subject came up. So what? Can't hold that against her. Women love money so much only because we men make it hard for them to get at it. They have to massage us and our egos to get it. Otherwise they wouldn't even bother with us. Except maybe for the occasional fuck. Not unlike how we treat them. We left the place. Not wanting to risk rejection, I didn't even try to kiss her on the cheek. I didn't want the friendship thing to become official. At least this way there was still some hope of sex. So I stood about 2 yards away from her, mind you, she wasn't exactly trying to close the gap, saying things like, I'll call you and see you soon. I prepared myself for the heartbreaking walk back to the hotel. Are you coming on Wednesday? I secretly leaped for joy. Oh yeah, I forgot, your exhibition. What's the address? Waving goodbye, I stomped off as if I had 1,000 other things to do in the direction of the Soho Grand. In the meantime, I was working in one of the most famous advertising agencies in the world on 2 of their toughest accounts, Harris Cameras and Minted Magazine. Miraculously, it was going okay. The boss seemed happy. I couldn't believe it because I was working on only half my cylinders. When the big night of Aisling's exhibition arrived, I was very nervous. I was going to meet her friends. In my mind, I'm still her boyfriend. We're just going through a bumpy patch. I mean, I didn't feel too confident about it. I had a nasty feeling that I would discover some stuff I wouldn't like. I got there and the event was already up and running. I pushed my way through the impressive crowd of fashionable, comfortable-looking people. People who appeared as if they were used to being loved. Strange thing to say, but that's how they looked to me. The sought-after. So I tried to find her, and couldn't at first. But I could see the huge photo collage on the back wall of the bar. That's all it was. A big bar with a big wall space at the back. An overall abstract impression composed of hundreds of black and white photos of subway workers and commuters. To me it was reminiscent of photographers from the 1920s or 1930s, a Russian Man Ray or John Hartfield, visually clever in the way she made the present day appear so retro. I was shocked that I liked it so much and pissed off. It meant that she was more talented than I'd feared. Not only had she stolen my heart, but now she'd stolen the life I would have loved to live had I had the courage not to go into advertising. I don't think this hit me consciously at the time, but I was uncomfortable. No, I was jealous. And to top it all off, when I did find her, she was holding a huge fucking iris that someone had given her, some guy no doubt, and a dirty great pint of Guinness. A pint of Guinness. I hadn't even seen one in about 4 years, let alone one attached to a girl I loved. Something cracked under my feet. I nodded politely and she introduced me to her friend, the tallest, most powerful girl I had ever seen. She must have been 6'7". She looked like she could pick me up and throw me out the window. She had come from Los Angeles specially to see her friend Aisling. I said that showed loyalty. She said rather infuriatingly that she did it because Aisling was going to be rich someday. I remember finding that odd. So I got stuck talking directly to this girl's midriff about sweet fuck-all with the two loves of my life, Guinness and herself, gliding around the bar and pecking everyone on the cheek. Her boss had even turned up. Peter Freeman, it turned out, was an emaciated, grey-haired-looking thing in a cardigan. He looked much older than I'd imagined. Early 50s. I remember being relieved and thinking, well, at least I don't have to worry about him. I bought the tall girl of Bailey's, and at my instigation we sat at a little table because I felt so ridiculous looking up her nostrils while feigning interest in her life in Los Angeles. All I wanted from her was information about her friend, my lover, the rising photographer. I got nothing, of course. We were sitting for a while when suddenly I felt a splatter of Bailey's across my face and chest. I looked at her incredulous. She was holding a plastic straw. She had flicked it at me. As I heard her apologize, I realized there was a droplet on my bottom lip. Smiling, I carefully wiped my chest and mouth. I was very aware that I only needed to lick my lips and anything could have happened. As it was, I had arranged with my AA friend Adam to meet me later if things got sticky. This, I decided, was sticky. It was good to have someone real I could go to and meet rather than having to limp out under some invented excuse. I sat for a while longer, and then, after getting her another Bailey's, ever the gentleman, I asked her to apologize to Aisling for me, as I had a dinner date. Happy day. I got out of there. The tall girl was over-apologetic and tried to grab my arm as she bade me to sit down again.